do begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. This is that secret episode I told you was going to happen before the end of the year. And for those who are just tuning in for the first time, you're like, what are you talking about? I have no idea. You're out of the loop. Well, the podcast has been on a break for the last month, and it's going to continue at least for the month of December. And, you know, the reasoning behind that was mostly because I obviously needed to kind of step back and recollect myself, reassess everything that's going on, and see how I can continue to improve on my content, on the quality of it, figuring out how to market myself, you know, all the nitty-gritty stuff that you don't see that is visible to the viewer. You know, for the most part, all you see is just the monkey mask and the cool pictures and the cool whatever it is that makes you interested in the podcast. You see that, but of course there's a lot of work that goes into it, and every now and then it can be a little overwhelming, you know, whether you know, think that much effort goes into this or not. Well, sorry to burst your bubble, but it does. So just like everything, you kind of, you know, you have to stay consistent, and you always got to find ways of improving little by little. You know, you got to chip away at your masterpiece to see where it goes. And if you fuck it up, well, then you fucked it up. But at least you tried. There was some effort. High five for effort. Nonetheless, the podcast is scheduled for new episodes in January 2021. So stay tuned. And if there is an episode between now and then, I'd probably say it'll be closer to Christmas. I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait. But you know what they say, good things come to those who wait. So, and yeah, I mean, I hope you guys for now enjoy this conversation. Today, my guest is Mr. Nanoski, and for the last 20 years, he has been an educator and an environmentalist, and he has made it his goal to basically educate the masses, specifically the youth, in terms of what it means to be human and what our impact is in our environment. Now, you may be asking yourselves, well, what does the environment ever do for me? Well, you're standing on it. You're breathing it. It's keeping you alive. It's keeping everything around you consistent with the way that the natural processes in this world abide by, you know? So it's important. And there's obviously a group of people out there that it may be for whatever reason. Maybe they're uneducated. Maybe they're uninformed. Maybe there is something out there that's holding them back from finding these type of resources. But the reality of the thing is climate change is real, and it's affecting us right now as we speak. It may not seem like it, you know, once we start seeing it in different forms and different perspectives, and we can start changing the way that we approach these things. But for the most part, I don't want to spoil the conversation. I hope you guys enjoy it. And if, you know, you have any questions, reach out to Nanoski himself. And I hope you guys walk out of this conversation with a little bit of new knowledge and a little bit more self-awareness of what it means to be on this planet. The last part here before we wrap this up is a music spotlight. Today's music's brought to you by Freedom Curse with their song Smile. You can check it out off their latest album. You can find them on Spotify and on Bandcamp. And as always, I recommend to go ahead and follow, support the music. There's nothing better than supporting local music. What else can I say? Enjoy it, and I'll see you guys next year. That's one of those jokes. Peace. Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. This is that secret episode I was telling you about that was going to happen. So, I mean, it's happening. We got the great Nanoski here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I think we've been kind of trying to set this up for, let's say, like at least a year or something.
Yeah, but maybe more than that.
You know, we made it happen. I think everything falls in place when it's supposed to. And I think this is why we're here now. So thank you again for taking the time out of your super busy school schedule. I know the Zoom meetings, I'm sure you're overwhelmed at this point.
Yeah, COVID teaching is a lot harder than teaching in person. It's a different ball game.
Damn, how do you see it moving forward? Like in terms of, I mean, you that you are in the shoes of a teacher, like how long do you see this like I don't know, taking in terms of online?
I mean, just in terms of like the current situation.
Yeah.
You know, well, if these vaccines work as well as they say they're going to work, and they get them out to the mass populace, the sooner the better. We could definitely be kind of back to normal sometime. I think either late summer or by next fall.
Yeah.
I definitely think some of the things that we've had to learn as teachers to teach through Zoom and just through all these different computer platforms, even when things do go back to normal, I think that's just going to like have added a lot of tools to our teaching kit.
Right.
In terms of all the things that we can do now that we can incorporate into the class. And so I think it definitely expands what's possible in terms of education, kind of teaching a hybrid, kind of a mix between in-person and a lot more online resources and applications that the kids have access to now.
There's still for sure need some tweaks. Like I'm the opposite side. I have my kid that I have to overlook when he's doing classes. So I'm on the other end trying to figure out like, oh man, this is some extra work that, you know, not that I wasn't used to it, but you're having to sit there and make sure that he's focused and not being distracted is like a whole new thing as well.
What grade are they in?
He's only a third grader. Okay. So, you know, he kind of had to start learning how to send emails and all this stuff by the age.
I think it would be a lot harder the younger they are.
Yeah.
When I'm dealing with high school kids, they're just a lot more sophisticated and they're already on it, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, so it's easier for them to kind of just, you know, pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely been a crazy. That's why I kind of mentioned, because I think New York up into the last few weeks, last week, I think they closed their public schools down.
Yeah.
You know, and here everything's online.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with like trying to go back too early, because there's all this kind of political pressure and pressure from families and the public to trying to get back to normal. But if the infection rate is too high in the surrounding community, it's just a waste of money and resources to like send people back to only like close yourself down 2 weeks later or a month later. It's just, you're wasting resources at that point. One of the things that I find really, it's really challenging teaching this way is just, we'll have these faculty meetings and the counselors and the school psychologists will get on the Zoom and they'll just tell us some of the things that kids are having to deal with. Mm. And just some really, really intense stuff. It's, you know, parents are dying. Grandparents are dying in their bed in the house. They're not even getting to the hospital. And, you know, people are losing their jobs. I got kids trying to go to class, you know, from inside of a car because their family's living in their car. And just there's so many different things going on. So, you know, you've got, you know, I think two of my classes, I had almost 50% fail rates. So I've never, ever, in all the time that I've been teaching, ever had so many students struggling.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of you is like, are people just, kids are taking advantage of the fact that, you know, they don't got to like, you know, bring it. Mm-hmm. Because I know all these other things they're going through. I've heard too much to know that there's kids dealing with some really serious stuff, and you have to be able to be accommodating and need to be flexible with what situations they're going through. You know, some things are more important to have to deal with than showing up to my Zoom session, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that's another whole thing that I bring up with my kid. You know, it's like sometimes, you know, there's two working parents, you know, in a lot of scenarios, you know, used to having to find a babysitter or find, you know, all this other stuff to make sure that they're in class. And then for me, there's been a few times where I'll get phone calls like, hey, your kid didn't make it to school, so on and so forth. And it's like, understandable, you know, I do my part to try to, you know, have him complete the books, make sure he completes his schoolwork. But at the same time, there's certain days where you really just can't have them be there in front of the screen for 5 hours while you're struggling work, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this situation has just really brought out the inequities in the system.
Yes.
I mean, I'll see a kid who's been trying to get into my class like 13 times in 50 minutes, and they'll get knocked out 2 minutes in, then they'll try to come back in. They'll get knocked out 3 minutes later, and that'll happen to them over 10 times in one class period. How's a kid like that supposed to go to learn?
Yeah.
You know, if they got bad internet or they got bad tech on their side. So it's just a lot of stuff that kids have to deal with. So even the ones that are showing up, they've got a lot of stuff to deal with in terms of not having access to the best that we could possibly provide them.
Yeah, right. I mean, I can see for the most part, you know, getting laptops for those people. In terms of what you teach, like, can you give us a little bit of background? I was personally a student of yours back in 2008, so it's been a while.
I started out teaching life sciences, biology, AP biology. And then I got AP environmental science added to my list of responsibilities. And I was always interested in environmental science and ecology because it's a major branch of biological sciences. But in teaching AP environmental science, it really made me every year dive deeper and deeper and deeper into ecological issues and the interconnectedness of the natural world. Mm-hmm. So I really, really just got more and more involved in it. And then I kind of became a botany nerd. Once I had gone down the ecological path, I kind of started really getting into like native species, native plants, native flora and fauna of Southern California, and just how we're a biological hotspot. Southern California is one of the most biologically diverse places on Earth. California chaparral is probably got more biodiversity in it than a tropical rainforest.
Okay.
So yeah, there's some, there's a lot of things that go on ecologically in Southern California, and a lot of it is imperiled and endangered because of all the urbanization and human population growth that's happening in the area. So that's really what got me to start a project with my students, which are the ELC Habitat Gardens. We have three distinct areas on campus that were basically just not being used. They were just basically like, you know, patches of weeds. Mm-hmm. And so I would ask the different principals that we had at the time, like, hey, could I use this like as an outdoor lab for my students? Can we like turn this into something? And every time they said yes. So now we have a desert habitat garden. We have a chaparral habitat garden and a vernal pool habitat garden. Nice. And we're pretty rare. It's a pretty rare thing to have habitat gardens the way that we have them at Elizabeth Learning Center at other public schools.
Did you find like there was a lot of pushback in the beginning in terms of that? Or,
you know, luckily I was kind of an ignorant person when it came to this. I really didn't understand that there was a whole lot of red tape involved. I was just like, I just want to take my kids out to nature. You know, the budget cuts and the red tape that they would make you go through to get a bus to go on a field trip and all the waivers and all the legal stuff that you had to go through. It was just really difficult to get my students to be able to go somewhere and learn something that wasn't just coming from the book or wasn't coming from one of my PowerPoint lectures or a video. I wanted them to get their hands on stuff. And so I decided, you know, it's time to bring nature to the school.
Right.
And so that's really what was the impetus for it. And I didn't worry about, are these plants like the official plants that LAUSD has approved to be landscaping plants? Like, you know, I didn't even know that world existed. I just did what I wanted to do with my students. Later on, there were issues and, you know, someone would come to our campus and be like, you have cactuses in the desert garden, you know, and they're not approved plants of the district. And I say, well, Southgate High School has roses, hundreds of rose bushes in front of their campus, and you have no problem with the thorns on those plants, so why would you have any problems with the plants I have?
That's crazy. Like, you know, it's easy for us to think like, for example, field trip, oh, why haven't our teachers taken us to field trips, like, or you know, little things, but you start saying,
you've just made it harder and harder and harder to do, you know. And I mean, I'm part of the technology academy at our school. And the structure of our academy allows the kids to go on certain field trips to have to do with the requirements to graduate from the academy with the tech certification. So when it has to do with that specific part of our goal as an academy, you know, we have somebody who can do all that paperwork and can do all the budgetary stuff. But if you want, if you're just a teacher who wants to like take the kids out to a state park or to a museum, just so much stuff you got to go through. It's it makes it a waste of your time. It's like they make you jump through so many hoops to then still potentially just be shot down.
Damn. Well, I mean, do you think that has to do with like the funding, or is it just like the district type?
It's a little bit of everything. It's funding. It's like limited resources. It's legal issues. So like there are lawyers and stuff. There's all these, just so much stuff. Liability insurance is so much stuff to go through.
With that being said, I really wanted to just kind of break down some of the stuff. The last couple of years have been for sure weird in terms of how we've kind of regressed in a lot of areas. And I wanted to kind of bring for sure some of the things that are on the front line, but a lot of people decide that it's not important, and that is climate change. Mm-hmm. I know recently California passed a law, or I think they passed legislation for, I think, 2035, that they want to ban all types of gas-powered cars.
Oh, yeah. This is Gavin Newsom did this in 2019, and it's actually not legislation. It's an executive order.
Oh, damn.
It's only executive orders that he wrote and he signed. So it doesn't actually have any teeth legislatively to be implemented. But because he could get away with doing an executive order in California, because California is a super blue state. Yeah. And we have super majorities of Democrats in the state Senate and the state House. So pretty much anything that Democrats want to do, they can pretty much do, because there's very little resistance from the Republican Party in California. Mm. So him signing an executive order is almost as good as it being legislation.
Gotcha. I mean,
yeah. If he was in a state where there was a lot more balance between left and right, it would have been really a hollow gesture. But because he's got so much Democratic backing, and a lot of the stuff that is in that executive order can actually be, you know, pushed
and gotcha.
Turn into legislation, turn into action.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, I mean, from my understanding, like, it seems like California is usually the air quote pioneer in terms of, I guess, progressive idea. Well, yeah. You know,
we definitely are. We're lucky to be in California. We have the strictest air quality control regulations of any state. Our standards are higher than those that are proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency, which is federal. And you would think federal would be the last word, but California really pushes the boundaries of clean water and clean air and renewable energy resources. And so California being a leader on those things really pushes a lot of other states to go in that direction, especially in the West.
Yeah, like coastal states for the most part, right?
Yeah. You know, there was actually a case, the Trump administration was actually bringing a case against California to basically say that our higher air pollution standards were unconstitutional. And so they were trying to actually argue in court that they should be struck down and that we should like toe in line with the EPA standards, which he's watered down. Huh. So now that Biden is the president-elect, those lawsuits will probably be shut down as soon as he's sworn in.
Yeah.
January. So we won't have to worry about that potentially being reversed or dropped.
Yeah. Again, 2035, that's where 2020, that's 15 years from now.
Like, yeah.
I don't know what they're going to do with the gas cards. Maybe they're going to do some sort of incentive program to trade them in or something. Well,
I think that's going to be probably a component of it, but the executive order only says that by 2035, no new gas powered cars can be sold. So any cars before 2035 that are combustion gas powered cars can be sold, can be drove. Mm-hmm. They're not outlawing gas powered vehicles. They're just saying by 2035, we're not selling any new ones anymore. So you could sell 2034, 2030, I mean, any model before 2035 can be sold and resold. And
yeah, you just won't have like the new, if you go to the Toyota Center or won't have the gas. Gotcha. So, I mean, that again, that relates to the first one. So saying that alternative energy resources are much more expensive and inaccessible to the public. Which, I mean, that's the argument that's been said. You know, there was a video. I don't know if I think I can pull it up here. Can you hear the video?
I'm not hearing anything.
Okay, so that's cool. Now, well, basically the video is...
Oh, that's you want. Maybe you're not sharing it with me. You might have to share your screen.
Oh, okay, let me see here.
You click share screen. Sometimes you'll be able to see another window where the video's at, and then you can click on that, and then I'd probably be able to hear it.
There you go. I see. Let's see. Okay, there we go. Zoom, and let's allow. Okay, so it looks like I'm not going to be able, because it's going to quit. It's going to kick me out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool. I mean, it's a video of Trump basically saying that he doesn't understand the winds, that, you know, they're just mass bird graves.
He says... I mean, obviously, we've had 4 years of this man saying things that if any other human being, if any other person who had been president had even said like 1/50th the things he has said over the last 4 years, I mean, they either would have lost their office or just something horrible would have happened to them politically. But he throws so much at you on a daily basis that's untrue, that after a while you just can't keep up. It's just like an onslaught. And so when he says things like windmills cause cancer and windmills kill billions of birds, he's taking something maybe he read about how, you know, early wind turbines, you know, there were a lot of raptor deaths, you know, birds of prey like to nest high up, and so, you know, top of a wind, you know, modern wind generator looks like a nice perch, you know, and when the blades aren't spinning, you know, maybe it's a nice place to land and look for prey and look for other things. And yes, have birds been hit by the blades and killed? Yes. Are there piles of bodies at the bottom of the... No, there isn't. So you might take something that's kind of true in a very small situation, but then he extrapolates and says windmills are killing all the birds on Earth, or, you know, really he didn't like the fact that when windmill farms are constructed, people don't like the aesthetics of it, so it drives down like property values. So if you've got a multi-million-dollar home on the coast, you know, off Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and you want to have your million-dollar view of the ocean, you don't want to look at windmills. You know, so it's more of a financial, like, you know, this is going to drive down the price of my, you know, expensive property, as opposed to it's like an ecological, you know, danger.
I'm pretty sure he passed it. Like he removed certain protections in terms, or he wanted to kickstart the steel and the coal.
Basically, it's kind of interesting because one of the conservative positions is to allow the free market to dictate what's going to survive in terms of a business. So coal, for example, the reason why people are losing jobs in coal is not because there's some conspiracy to take coal out. Coal is just not as competitive as... solar is anymore. Solar has gotten really, really cheap. And so now you can get a decent solar for way cheaper than it costs to go and do mountaintop removal in Appalachia to get to the coal underground and then put it on trains and then burn it. And it's just more expensive. So a lot of coal miners are losing their jobs simply because of the free market. Because renewables are becoming competitive with coal or becoming cheaper than coal. And then you have automation. There's a whole bunch of jobs in the coal sector that are automated now. So now a machine does a job that a human used to do. And so that drives the unemployment rate up even higher in that part of the world. So they need a scapegoat. And the scapegoat is renewable energy. Got to blame somebody.
Yeah, and it's easy, and I mean, it's easy to point your finger at something that you don't fully understand either, right? You know, it's just affecting you. You see the, like, just the what am I trying to say here? Like the surface level, superficial level stuff of things, and you're like, this guy's right. This is, I don't want the birds to die. This looks ugly. No, but that's it's a short term vision instead of long.
Yeah, it's funny to hear a guy who's environmental protection agency is run by people that were the heads of the most polluting corporate interest anywhere in the sector, and then to sit there in front of a crowd and say he's concerned about the birds. When he's totally fine with like allowing pesticides to be on your food that cause birth defects in children and cause all the amphibians in the environment to grow eight legs and die. He's fine with all of that happening, but you know, gotta save the birds from the windmills.
God, what a guy. I mean, you're at this point, you're glad that he's at the finish line right now. Like, just get out of here, man. Like,
well, you know, I'm more worried right now that, you know, between now and January 20th, I mean, he's like a cornered animal now, you know, and cornered animals can do really, really scary things when they feel like they're, you know, up against a wall.
Damn. Well, I mean, let's you know, fingers crossed, you know, because we were able to do 4 years of this.
There is a finish line. The finish line is approaching.
So moving to the second myth here that I saw this other video. So it says, just I briefed it up here. So it says the weather seems fine. It's cold when it's cold. It's hot when it's supposed to be hot. What's the big deal? Again, it's these short terms that you're leaving at the moment. You don't see how it's going to affect you. And
well, it's kind of interesting because I think you brought up that we might talk about like flat earth conspiracy theories and stuff. In a way, believing the earth is flat is kind of almost the same kind of a mistaken cognition that people also have with climate change, because it's like you're very small on the surface of a huge sphere. Mm-hmm. And so you're only able to see a very small part of it. And so because you're so small, all you see is flatness. So if you're going to go by your own subjective, you know, perception through your senses, then of course the world's flat.
Yeah. You know?
And the same thing's true about climate change. You know, climate is something that takes place on vast scales of time, hundreds to thousands to millions of years. And so a human lifetime is simply not even enough time to perceive any dramatic changes in terms of climate. And even that being said, we do have enough data over the hundreds of years that humans have been keeping records of different aspects of the atmosphere and the oceans. And then the information we get from like the fossil record, paleoclimatic reconstructions of fossil pollen and air bubbles trapped in glaciers that are, you know, 500,000 years old. So you can suck that bubble of air out of ice that's 500,000 years old, and you can know what was in the atmosphere 500,000 years ago and compare it to today's atmosphere and see what's changed. So when you combine all those different types of data, it's really crystal clear that what humans have been doing since we left Africa has been having permanent effects on the planet. Like, a lot of people don't realize that when our ancestors left Africa, one of the first things they did was cause the extinction of what we call the megafauna, the large mammals on Earth, things like mammoths, things like giant ground sloths. We had these huge mammals on every continent, and wherever humans migrated, within a couple of thousand years, those large animals are gone.
Due to hunting.
I mean, these are animals that had never seen a human before. So when, I don't know if people are aware of this, but when humans go to a really remote place on Earth, like some remote island that humans have never been to before, the animals and stuff on those islands act as though they're tame. You can like walk up to birds and stuff and you can pick them up and put them on your arm because they've never seen a human before. Mm-hmm. They don't know to fear us. They've never seen us before. They don't know that we could be predatory. And so, you know, the dodo, you know, went extinct because when sailors went to the island to stock up on meat, they just walked up to these big, giant, flightless pigeons and clubbed them over the head. They didn't run away. They didn't fight back because, again, humans were a new thing on the scene and they didn't know to fear us. That's why the only megafauna left on Earth are in Africa. The giraffes, the elephants, the rhinos, the hippos, they exist still because they evolved with our ancestors and learned to fear humans very early in our evolution. So when they saw a group of us approaching them 300,000 years ago, they ran.
Yeah, they were like, peace.
Yeah, exactly. They evolved with us and learned to fear us. And that's the only reason why the large mammals on Earth still exist in Africa.
I like how this kind of just flows into the next myth here. You know, like you mentioned, like you can take a bubble out of a million year of a piece of ice and you can see what the environment was then. Like how you see it now, like people say, oh, well, Earth goes through climate changes all the time. This is just normal. Why are you making a big deal about it?
Yeah. So one of the issues with that, is it true that in the past that we have had major cycles of extremely hot planet Earth and extremely cold planet Earth? And the answer is totally yes. You can go back, over 160 million years ago when the parts per million of carbon dioxide was over 2,600. You know, that's extraordinarily high. Today we're over 400. So somebody could look at that and go, well, there was a time in the past when Earth was extraordinarily hot, like Venus hot. And that's true. And there's been times where we've had glacial periods where the parts per million of carbon dioxide went down to like 160 ppm, which is extraordinarily low, which is why the Earth got really cold and icy. Mm-hmm. And so someone could take those extremes from the past and go, okay, then what's the big deal? We're over 400 parts per million now. And the answer is that humans didn't exist when those cycles were occurring in the Earth's past. And those cycles took place over millions of years. They didn't happen in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
So one of the issues with human-caused climate change, or what we call anthropogenic climate change caused by human activity, is the change is happening at a speed that never happened in the past. So even when you have those extremes of a very hot Earth and a very cold Earth, they happened gradually over the time. They didn't like take place within a century. They didn't take place within a millennium. These were transitions from hot to cold that took place over tens of thousands to millions of years. So evolution of animals and plants, they had the time to change because the change was gradual. So their evolution was gradual. Whereas we're making things happen so fast, species can't keep up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's unnatural how fast the change is happening. I mean, it literally is happening now within our lifetime. We're seeing things happen. I mean, I don't know if anybody could deny that there aren't more 90 and 100 degree days per year now.
Yeah.
That every single year is the hottest year on record when the previous year was the hottest year on record. And that's been going on now for over a decade.
Jesus. Yeah, I mean, that's why I think people don't fully understand. It's just like you said, the acceleration of how this is happening, like within the time frame that we've been around. I almost assume that the majority of those changes can happen like industrial, industrial.
When they decided to call the Holocene, kind of to rename it the Anthropocene, they kind of go back to when agriculture began in the Middle East. So about 12,000, 13,000 years ago, when our species was able to take over the growth and development and the breeding of our plants and animals, our food supply. So our getting our hands on these species, plants and animals, and then, you know, with our big brains, changing them and selectively breeding for them and making them larger and, you know, and stripping the land so we can make more room for the plants and animals we wanted to eat. That was really, I think, the first big pulse that humans had on the planet that started to leave a permanent mark of our existence on Earth, something that future archaeologists would see in the fossil record. They'd see things that humans had done to the air, had done to the soil, had done to the oceans, chemical differences that have changed on all parts of the planet caused by just our species.
Do you think, like, hypothetically speaking, if we continue on this course of not reducing like the emissions, or, you know, just trying to take control, air quotes, of the climate change stuff that's going on? I mean, we can't evolve fast enough for that, because that's...
Well, here's one of the really interesting things about our species. Our species probably became the big-brained ape that we are because of climate change during the Pleistocene. So going from a environment in Africa near the equator, which never ever really experienced winter during the last major ice age, it would have made Africa very dry. It wouldn't have been like icy. There would have been no glaciers, but it would have made things at the equator very dry and forced animals like our ancestors out to places where things were more fertile or there was more rain. And that's really what our ancestors did. They just followed their food out of Africa. Wherever the animals migrated, our ancestors followed them because that was their food.
Right.
And so it wasn't like humans were like, hey, I wonder what's over there. It was like, oh, the animals are migrating this year more north. Let's go and move north with the animals. And we ended up in parts of the world, you know, that we had never been before simply because of climate change. So our species is actually pretty well adapted to the environment changing. Really what our issue now is that our technology is so advanced. It's almost we've become too good at destroying things. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to like cut trees down with a wooden axe. It's another thing to have a big mechanized machine cut the whole entire tree down, strip all the branches off for you, and then load it onto a truck and then send it somewhere. Where our technology is just having these big giant machines that are huge shovels. You know, it's one thing to have a hand shovel to dig a hole. It's another to have this big gigantic machine that can dig, you know, 2,000 pounds of, you know, dirt, you know, per every minute.
Yep. It's just,
exactly. Or the nets that we put in the oceans now that can stretch for hundreds of miles and capture every kind of thing that's, you know, within 50 feet of the surface. You know, it's like fish have nowhere to go. You know, you've got sonar, so you know exactly where they're at. You know exactly how deep they are. You know exactly where you need to put the net. So our technology is just so advanced. We're so good at using technology to exploit the environment that it's, you know, to our detriment now.
So do you think we're screwed?
I think we're screwed. I mean, I don't think I would teach AP Environmental Science if I was a total pessimist. Yeah. You know, I mean, I always tell my kids at the beginning of the semester, you're going to learn a lot of depressing things about the world. There's a lot of things that are happening in the world that are not good things. But I also think that we can use our large brains for good. You know, that there for every single problem we've created, we know the solution. And sometimes the solution is leave things alone.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, you know, I've been vegan for over 20 years. There's a new study that just came out. University of Oxford did this 5-year longitudinal study looking at over 40,000 different farming situations in 119 countries, and basically concluded that going vegan would drop your personal carbon footprint by about 75%. And not only would it drop your individual carbon footprint, your ecological footprint, the damage your existence causes to the environment, it would also free up enough land. About 75% of the land we're currently using to grow food could be allowed to go back to the wild. Damn. So you can feed the whole human population on a quarter of the land we're currently using if everybody went vegan.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't make people do something like that. You know, it's something they have to come to on their own. Mm. But, you know, as land becomes more scarce, as climate change causes more droughts, so that some parts of the world will get too much rain, right? They'll get too much rain because that's really what climate change is about. It's about extremes. It's not like the world's getting too hot, it won't rain anymore. It just means that climate change is going to cause extremes in rain and extremes in drought. So places that might have had only a little bit of drought, they're going to get a lot more drought. Places that used to like get enough decent rain might get way too much rain and have massive flooding. So you're just going to get these massive extremes, and the land that you're using to grow for animal agriculture, for dairy and for meat, it takes up a lot of real estate. So going vegan is probably the single most impactful thing an individual can do to try to bring back down the levels of methane and the levels of CO2, you know, back to like, you know, early industrial levels.
Yep.
1900s.
I've recently started kind of venturing into like veganism. Like I'm definitely still like in the.
I'm very jealous of you that you went to modern vegan.
Honestly, again, it's like I got introduced to it by my girlfriend, honestly, it was a big change for me because you know I've ate meat for almost all my life.
Yeah.
But, You know, once I kind of started learning a little bit more about it, I started going to these vigils, you know, right here in Vernon, there's a St.
Dodger Dogs.
Dodger Dogs come from, yeah. You're there and you see, like, you know, I went, you see the trailers pass and you see the pigs inside, and there's this emotion you get from just really seeing, you know, where they're going to go. You know, once they open that gate, they're gone.
Yeah.
And it was just like eye opening, you know? So I've definitely removed like pork products out of my diet. I'm still working on like chicken and like beef, but you know.
You know, it takes a while. It's not something you can do overnight. You know, when I first met Miss Parker, I wasn't vegan yet. She had been vegan for years and years before me. Mm-hmm. And this is when it was hard to be a vegan, because like she had to become a master chef. And she had to like cook everything herself. It wasn't like you go to the supermarket today and there's just all these vegan options. It's never been easier to be a vegan. You can go to any fast food place now and they have a vegan option, at least one. You can go to any grocery store now and they've got vegan options. It's just becoming a lot more popular, and it's not even becoming popular necessarily because people care about the environment so much. People care about their health.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and a lot of people are doing it just for health reasons. Now, all these other good reasons happen because you're interested in your health. There's ecological reasons and there's ethical reasons. And there's all these other good reasons to eat that way. But most people, it's a health issue. You know, they want to feel healthy about themselves. And so that's driving a lot of this, spread into, you know, I forget who I was talking to, but... they were saying something about how, you know, people shouldn't go to like Carl's Jr. and buy their Beyond Burger. You shouldn't go to like, you know, to Burger King and buy their Impossible Burger. And I was like, well, if you want veganism to spread, if you want a plant-based option to be available to more and more people, you need to go to those kind of businesses and support when they offer it. You know, you can't be a purist about it, because if you're going to like try to be a purist and say you can only eat vegan food at a pure vegan restaurant, I mean, it's never going to get to the masses. It's never going to spread and be a part of people's daily lives.
Exactly. And I mean, for the most part, I mean, here in, you know, I'm in Southeast LA, for a lot of years, it was a food desert. You know, it was just available everywhere you went. And now, like you said, I go to the grocery store and I see options.
Oh, yeah. Northgate, Superior, they all got like so many vegan options.
You know, and it's, I mean, especially me coming from a Mexican family, meat is on every dish 3 times a day. So
it's a cultural thing. It's literally part of your culture. So, you know, half my family's Mexican on my mom's side. And just when I started becoming vegetarian, I mean, I was still eating cheese and I was still eating eggs, but when I was vegetarian, she would feel so offended that I did not want to eat meat. Like I was offending her.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'd be like, Mom, you're making some pasta. Could you just set aside a little bit of the tomato sauce before you put the hamburger meat in? And she would look at me and then she would just put more hamburger meat. Like I was just insulting her and I was insulting our culture. And, you know, that's how a lot of people take it. They take it like, you know, you're rejecting where you come from.
You know, it's funny because my son, he's 8 years old, but he considers himself a vegan. Like, you know, I buy him stuff. He's always like, can I see the packaging? Like,
this. Oh, wow.
Like, it's just amazing to see him so young and kind of, I'm ignorant in terms of what long-term effects it might have, but for the most part, it's something that he took up on his own, and he's like, no, I don't want to eat animal, you know? And it's just crazy, you know, how so young, and that's not just him. There's a bunch of other kids nowadays that are within that, you know, little box in terms of what they want to do with their diet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Miss Parker and I, when we adopted our son, we told him, you know, just cause we're vegan doesn't mean you have to be, you know, you're your own person, you know, we're going to respect whatever you want to do. You know, you want me to go get you a burger at Carl's Jr., I'll go get you one. You know, I'm not going to impose, you know, the choice I made. Mm-hmm. And I only made that choice after a lot of thinking and a lot of reading and a lot of debating and a lot of talking to people to arrive at something that important, such a key aspect of your ethical core. You just don't come across it overnight. It doesn't happen from reading one article, you know, really, you know, in order to holistically change your worldview like that, it takes some time. take some time, and not just for your mind to adjust, but for your body to adjust when you start actually implementing it.
So, I mean, with that being said, you're saying that that's one of the steps that we can take to reducing those carbon footprints.
It's the most immediate. It's the one impactful thing, because a lot of people think, you know, okay, if climate change, because you've got either climate denial, like everything's normal, the Earth's done this before, you know, so let's not change our whole entire economic system for something that nature's been doing naturally. Or you have the opposite extreme, everything's going to shit, so why even try? If it's already going to, like, be bad, like, you know, why do anything? And, you know, either extreme is not true. You know, so for example, if we just kept on polluting the way we're polluting and doing what we're doing, the temperature of the Earth is going to go up 4 to 5 degrees Celsius by the next, you know, 80 years. But that'll be a very hot planet. It'll be a very hot planet, very extreme climatic situation, but it won't cause the extinction of humanity. Yeah. Will it be a horrible planet to live on for a lot of people? Yes. Will there be more starvation? Yes. Will there be more malnutrition? Yes. If the global warming causes the expansion of the oceans as is happening, you're going to have people, about half the world's population lives within 25 miles of a coast. Yeah. So if you have 6 to 8 meters of sea level rise in the next 100 years, that's a lot of the major cities of the world underwater. You're going to have over 1 billion people, maybe 2 billion people on the move, trying to find higher ground.
Yeah.
Right, we can barely handle when, you know, people are coming over our border because of political instability and stuff in their countries. Can you imagine us, what we're going to do when, you know, 1 billion people are trying to cross the border because where they used to live is slowly sinking beneath the waves? It's going to cause a lot of, it's just going to cause a lot of strife. Yeah. Our species isn't going to go extinct. It's just many, many more of our kind are going to live miserable lives.
This is very funny and just a perfect example of what we're seeing in government in terms of how they're approaching climate change. Mm-hmm. And there's this video. Let me see if I pull it up. You can't see it, but it was a senator. He's from Oklahoma, Republican, and his name's James Inhofe, I believe.
Inhofe. Well, he's the dude who infamously picked up the snowball. Yeah, well, see, the issue with him, or the issue with a lot of people who are climate deniers, is they mistake weather and climate. Weather and climate are not the same thing. Weather is what the atmosphere is doing on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, whereas climate is the long-term patterns of the atmosphere and the oceans over millions of years or tens of thousands of years. So the analogy I like to use so people can know the difference is imagine that there's a homeless person. That homeless person, right, is living on the streets, doesn't have enough money to even, like, you know, pay for a night at a hotel, sleeping in the park, got all his stuff in a shopping cart. And one day when he's begging for money on the side of the street, a kind stranger walks by and hands him a $100 bill. So he's got $100 for that day. That $100 is weather. That guy's state of homelessness is climate. So just because on a particular day some generous stranger gives you enough money to have a hotel room for the night or enough money to go and buy food for a week or two, it doesn't mean you're still not homeless, right? So just because one day was really, really hot or one day was really, really cold, it doesn't mean that the world isn't getting warmer and warmer over time. You know, when people pick up that snowball and say, look at all this snow, where's the global warming? It's snowing so much. I always like to say, well, where do you think all the snow came from? Snow comes from water. And the only way you get that much water in the atmosphere is increased evaporation. And how do you get increased evaporation? Higher temperatures. So even a lot of snow falling. So even if you had a part of the world where you're like, wow, it snowed 3 times more this year than it did last year, that extra snow is because somewhere on Earth it was way hotter and caused more water evaporate and go into the atmosphere to make more snow somewhere else. So even an extreme winter storm is evidence of climate change.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like, there's all these people involved when they don't even know what the hell they're talking about.
I mean, unfortunately, there's no IQ test necessary to run for office.
Yeah, movies.
It was interesting. I don't know if you've seen Obama had put out a memoir, and he's been doing interviews about his book, and he said something to the effect, or maybe someone who was interviewing him said something to the effect that basically the people that we elect are just a reflection of the people. You know, it's not, it's, you know, this person's not ignorant on climate change because, you know, people wanted somebody ignorant on climate change. That person's ignorant about climate change because the voters who voted for him are ignorant about the issues of climate change. It's really up to our leaders and to our teachers and to, you know, to educate our fellow citizen about what's going on so that collectively together we can reverse some of these dramatic changes that we've made to the planet that undermine our existence.
Damn. I do hope there is there is people within the government that are trying to do that. Like, you know,
that's interesting. I mean, the Green New Deal was introduced by AOC in the House. And then I'm forgetting who sponsored it in the Senate, but it was basically a non-binding resolution. It was not legislation. It was basically just a non-binding resolution, basically is like your aspirations. Here's what we would like to do. That's all it was. That's all the Green New Deal was. It's like, here's what we would like to do, not that we have to do it. There was nothing binding. There is no vote to make it legislative. But again, the powers that be, like the fossil fuel industry and stuff, you know, they start to demonize it, you know, because it's a threat to their profit margins to go away from fossil fuels.
Right. And then you start, yeah, and you have people just saying how it's like a super progressive and like it's going to take people's jobs away. I mean, that's what people don't want to hear. You know, they don't want to hear that it's going to affect them, again, their livelihood, but you're not really seeing the long term effect.
The other thing is just people don't know what they don't know, right? There's what you know you don't know, and then there's what you don't know you don't know. And so, for example, the majority of new jobs now in the energy sector in the United States are in solar. Like, if you count, I think it's something like 3 million people now have jobs in the solar sector, and that's more jobs than all the fossil fuel industries combined. Coal, natural gas, oil. So, I mean, again, it's the free market talking. The free market is speaking, and the fossil fuel industry is trying their darndest so that no one else hears what the market's saying.
Yeah.
Right? You know, oil, you still need oil and you still need gasoline. You still, even though everything's trending towards the renewable sector, and that's with the renewable sector not getting the subsidies that the fossil fuel industry gets. We give billions of dollars to the coal and oil industries to lower their costs. So the reason why gasoline can be so cheap or why coal can be so cheap is because the federal government is cutting these guys a really huge check to drive the price down artificially. Mm-hmm. So that it is available to the masses at a very low price. If you gave those same subsidies to the renewables, to wind and to solar and geothermal, they would fly off. You know, they would like grow exponentially, even more they're growing right now. They have to fight against those subsidies to even be equal or to lower their cost compared to fossil fuels.
Damn, but it's again, so cutting into that margin, you start like lobbyists come in, you know?
Yeah, there's just still a lot of power there. I mean, there's just still a lot of oil money and still a lot of fossil fuel money. And you're kind of like seeing the last gasp of a dinosaur going extinct.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it is. You know, like, I don't know how much longer they can hold on to that kind of political power. It's just becoming easier and easier and easier to do the renewable thing. And again, it's the free market speaking. It's the free market that's not being subsidized that's doing the moving of those jobs. It's just that people don't realize it. And in most normal everyday lives, people are too busy to think about stuff like this.
I mean, at that point, do you think it's mostly just about being educated and voting people in who represent those changes?
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, you'd hope that people educate themselves enough that when they go to vote, they're voting for the person who's the most intelligent choice for a broad range of issues. A lot of people, unfortunately, they vote and they're only like single issue kind of voters. You know, like you might only vote because you don't like abortion, or you might only vote because you think immigrants are the cause of all your problems. So if you're a single issue voter, you're not thinking about the bigger picture. You're not thinking about the wider ramifications of what your vote represents. So you vote very myopically. It's like you've got blinders on and you can only see what's directly in front of you, and you don't see anything. You don't see the bigger picture of things. Yeah. And until we have more and more people who are looking at the bigger picture voting, which I think the youth is doing. I think, you know, your son's a good example of how much information he already knows, the kind of choices that he's deciding to make at such a young age. Right. I think that gives me some optimism. That's why I teach AP Environmental Science, because I'm hoping that the next generation is going to have a lot more knowledge on hand to make better decisions and put more intelligent people in charge of making these decisions on our behalf.
Yeah. Damn. I mean, it's a powerful wave if we allow it to develop, you know, like it's.
Sometimes, you know, some people, you know, sometimes things have to get really, really bad before they can get better.
Yeah.
You know, it's like COVID-19, you know, it's something that people can't see. You can't see the virus doing something actually to you. You can turn on the news and hear that 2,000 people a day are dying, but if it's not happening right in front of your face, if it isn't happening to a loved one of yours personally, it's out of sight, out of mind. It's like, wow, over 90% of people get it and they recover, no problem. And you look around and most people are still doing fine and most people in your family are doing fine. So you think, well, I guess I don't really have to wear the mask, or, hey, I'm going to go visit my friends. You know, I don't have to like be 6 feet away. And you let your guard down. And then that's when the whole thing surges, is when everybody's letting their guard down and they start to not, because they aren't seeing it with their own eyes. The virus is an invisible thing. And so, again, out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. I mean, you can say that issue with the climate change again.
Exactly. You aren't seeing, you may not be seeing the kinds of dramatic changes in front of your own face. You don't know that the ice is melting in the Arctic and Antarctic at speeds that have never happened naturally. You know, sea level is going up. It's very incremental. But, you know, when there's a high tide and your streets are flooding in Miami and you're having to spend $600 billion to put pumps in to try to push the ocean back out so that people can, you know, keep their property, you know, it isn't until that kind of stuff's literally flooding your front yard until that you're like, oh, I guess maybe there is something to this. So it really is unfortunate that things may have to get really, really bad in order for enough people to finally change their minds on things.
If we get to that point where it gets really bad, I mean, at that point, can we reverse something that big, or is that something we just have to adapt to?
Well, I mean, like I said, you can do what you can do in your life. So for example, in my starting ELC Habitat Gardens, you know, that's my small little contribution to hopefully greater change. You know, I've now had hundreds of students pass through my classroom since they were established, have worked on the Habitat Gardens, have learned about nature, have observed nature, have done different kinds of labs on how photosynthesis works and how symbiosis works. And so just exposing my kids to nature, them having the ability to interact with it, to see it in action, I'm hoping that that is something that stays with them. I'm hoping it's something that stays in their mind and helps to influence their way of thinking about other things. That experience. Oh my God, my cats are not liking each other right now. Yeah, they're good. That's funny. Serious point. I think that what I do in my classroom has ripple effects in the greater world, because my students are going to leave me and they're going to go and live their lives. And then anything that I was able to teach them about respecting nature, about the importance of nature, about the importance of the systems, the importance of the ecological service, all the things nature gives us for free, like the oxygen we breathe and the soil that allows our food to grow, all these, the magic of all of that, I'm hoping that that sticks with them and influences how they understand other things about the world, influences them as future voters, you know, of our future governments, maybe even, you know, them running for office and taking control of local situations and national situations and having greater influence. So something maybe I said to them 10 years ago is going to have some amazing effect, you know, 20, 30 years later that I'm never even going to get to see. I have to be optimistic about that what my students learn in my class and learn in those habitat gardens and learn from that science club, you know, the science club, I started that also to get kids out of the classroom and, you know, get them hands-on. You know, I've taken students to the Channel Islands and they interacted with like marine biologists and ichthyologists and marine bird scientists. And I had many students who just on that one trip decided, I'm going to be a marine biologist. I'm going to be an ecologist. So I've had a lot of kids go on to major and get master's degrees and PhDs and, you know, environmental engineering. And so I see that it has effects. I see like, okay, this person's doing something with their life to help contribute positively in ways that are going to help all of us. So I have to hope that that's what continues to happen.
Damn. No, I mean, I honestly think you have that impact already, you know, and for the same reason that there was moments that I had that really opened my eyes in terms of what was really going on in my environment.
Well, I mean, the reason why, you know, I finally said, you know what, I just need to do this podcast is because I've listened to some of the podcasts that you've done. I just think it's an amazing thing to just be able to sit down and have a conversation. I like to call them mind walks. You go on a mind walk, you're just like, you know, let's go and explore something intellectually. Let's like talk about things and kind of dive into them a little bit deeper. And not everybody has the opportunity to do that. You know, some people are just working their butts off. They're working three jobs just trying to make ends meet. You know, there's just people that don't always have the time to be able to sit down and have the luxury. So, you know, maybe they have the ability to just listen to a podcast and listen to other people talking about something in depth. And then that's going to help them, you know, be able to understand something at a deeper level. So again, those ripple marks keep on going out. Yeah. In a positive way.
Now, Nanoski, I appreciate you so much for really taking the time. And I hope people who listen to this snap something in them and says, you know what, I got to take different course in what I'm doing.
Yeah. That's all we can hope for, you know, all humans have an intellect. All humans have the ability to reason. And if you can talk to somebody in a way that's non-threatening, that allows them to learn something new about the world in a way that maybe they've never seen or heard about it before, it's going to allow them in the privacy of their own thoughts to maybe make a change, to think of something differently, to do something differently that maybe they would not have had the courage to do had they not been illuminated by a cool conversation or a cool podcast or a cool book that gives them knowledge.
Well, you definitely blew my mind a lot of the times right now. So I really do appreciate that again.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. I'm honored.
If people want to, let's say, you know, pick your brain, is there any particular place or do you have any maybe some sort of online lectures or something that is available for people to kind of just...
Well, I mean, I guess if people really want to contact me, they could write email me. That's probably the best way to like just get in contact with me in a way that I would like, you know immediately that somebody wants me to like contact him or give them some kind of feedback.
All right, cool. Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely make sure to, you know, if they ask
email. So if you want to put it out there, I'm all for that.
All right, sounds good. I appreciate you, and hopefully it's not the last time we, you know, do this.
Definitely not. Yeah, I really appreciate what you're doing, Eddie. Very cool.
Thank you. You know, I'm trying.
You are. That's all we can do.
All right, man. Well, enjoy your holiday, and I'll see you soon.
Yeah. All right, Eddie. You have a good Thanksgiving week.
I sailed the seas for centuries for nothing.